Good evening. A former president of Peru kills himself moments before his arrest on corruption charges. A new report says Mayor de Blasio violated ethics rules while seeking donations, and a Lower East Side community faces the effects of climate change. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
And I'm Heather Chin.
With the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, April 17th, 2019. The Trump administration announced a series of measures against Cuba today. These included travel restrictions and caps on the amount of money Americans can send to family, as well as allowing U.S. citizens to sue the Cuban government for compensation over property seized 60 years ago. The new measures were announced by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton, who also revealed that the U.S. was imposing new sanctions against banks in Venezuela and Nicaragua. The policy changes escalate U.S. stances against both Cuba's communist government and Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro, who Trump and other Latin American leaders have declared illegitimate.
The Turkish capital of Istanbul has a new mayor, and he is a member of the country's main opposition party, the Republican People's Party, which won a narrow election victory against President Tayyip Erdogan's leading AK party. The election results are being appealed.
And Peru's former president, Alan Garcia, died after shooting himself in the head as officials arrived to arrest him on money laundering and bribery charges. The charges stemmed from a massive corruption scandal that involved him granting infrastructure contracts to a Brazilian construction company in exchange for kickbacks that he then used to pay more bribes to politicians. Some through banks in the U.S., in Peru, Mexico, Venezuela, Colombia, Argentina, and Mozambique. Jo Marie Burt is Associate Professor of Political Science at George Mason University. She says Garcia was the latest of three former Peruvian presidents to fall in the scandal that's rocked the continent.
The Odebrecht scandal has, as you're saying, it has been an earthquake throughout the region. Through the investigations that have been carried out for the past couple of years, starting in Brazil and then, you know, actually coming into the United States, U.S. investigators have been investigating the case as well. We've learned that this company has paid over $800 million in bribes to secure government public work contracts throughout the region. And this scandal has brought down presidents across the region, this being sort of the most, I would say, the most dramatic moment, given Garcia's, the prosecutors were at his doorstep. They were about to arrest him. He turned around, went back into his house from the accounts that I've read, and went into a room and shot himself. So it looked like to me that he preferred ending his life to facing charges on these cases. And it seemed like the noose was, he was ensnared in this corruption deal, and he just decided he did not want to face the music here, it seems to me.
Who is Alan Garcia, and why is he important?
Alan Garcia was twice the president of Peru, first between 1985 and 1990, and then again in 2006 and 2011. In his first term, he was sort of a populist firebrand. He railed against the International Monetary Fund and U.S. imperialism and said that Peru would stop paying its foreign debt because it had to focus on, you know, development projects and feeding its people and ending poverty. And he promised to fight Peru's shining past, this Maoist very violent insurgency, not with barbarism, his words were, we can't fight barbarism with barbarism. And he promised to respect human rights, and that quickly fell away. And his populism sort of also fell away. The country fell into a kind of an economic tailspin. So really, when people think about Alan Garcia's first government, they think of disastrous economy, where the country's, you know, hyperinflation rates were 7,000% in 1 year. I was living in Lima at the time, and it was just incredible to see this disintegration of the economy. And at the same time, the political violence just sort of expanded and multiplied, and the government's response was just sort of indiscriminate violence, and so you had a spiraling of political violence. Then, you know, he left the country when Fujimori became president. When he carried out his coup in 1992, it seems like they were going to arrest Alan Garcia, but he managed to hide and flee the country, and he went into exile and lived outside of the country for many years. Until he returned, he ran for president in 2001 and didn't win, but he did win again in 2006. And this time he kind of reconfigured himself as sort of a respectable elder statesman, sort of more of a neoliberal, conservative fiscally. But the theme that runs through, I think, both of his governments is the theme of corruption. The dollar MUP, the exchange rate, there were debt buy-offs. There was all a series of scandals, but he managed to evade investigation and any prosecution. So you've got, I think it's three presidents in Peru who are being, they're either in jail or being accused of, and they're being investigated in, Odebrecht-related corruption.
What is Odebrecht?
Odebrecht is a Brazilian corporation that basically engages in construction and other related projects. They have built some of the biggest infrastructure projects across the region. So the electric train that Garcia built finally in his second government, after abandoning the project in his first government, 20 years later, he's like, I'm going to finish this electric train. And there's rumors that there was corruption involved in that whole project. The current charges, I've been reading up on it, and there's some of it is involved in having received illegal election campaigns from Odebrecht. And some were much more recent. There was a more recent charge of him receiving $100,000, presumably for giving a conference to some industrial group in São Paulo. But that money actually came from Odebrecht.
In the end, did democracy win out in Peru after, you know, 20 or after 30 years of civil war, extremely violent repression in both directions from the left against the government and from the government against the left? Did in the end democracy win out in Peru?
That's a great question. I mean, Peru's democracy is absolutely a democracy in progress, right? This is not a, you know, consolidated democracy where everyone is living happily after. However, political violence is virtually non-existent. Security is an issue, but it's not nearly as bad as other parts of the region, Brazil, for example, or Central America. It's not nearly as bad. There are free and fair elections, which there were not during the Fujimori government. But we have this problem of massive corruption, which is, I think, the flip side of weak institutions. And so Peru's democracy, like many of the democracies in Latin America, I think still has a way to go to figure out ways to weed out corruption and consolidate more transparent and fair ways of doing business and of governing its people.
Jo Marie Bird is Associate Professor of Political Science at George Mason University.
In national headlines, the 18-year-old Florida woman described by officials as infatuated with the Columbine High School shooting was found dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Her body was found in Colorado after a 24-hour manhunt, which was reportedly sparked by online comments and her flight to the Denver area, where she purchased a gun and ammunition.
And scientists were able to restore brain activity in some brain cells of dead pigs even 4 hours after death, offering hope for research into treatment for strokes, drownings, massive heart attacks, and other conditions.
And the Justice Department announced indictments of fraud against 60 doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and other medical professionals for allegedly selling opioid prescriptions in exchange for sex and money. They were caught in a month-long sting operation focused on the Appalachian region.
In New York news, the measles vaccine mandate will remain in place in Williamsburg in spite of legal opposition from parents who oppose vaccinating their children. A hearing is scheduled for Thursday in the parents' lawsuit against the city. More than 300 people, most of them children, are confirmed as having contracted measles since October 2018. Over 3,000 minors in Williamsburg have not been vaccinated.
The city has unveiled an electric truck program with the goal of reducing air pollution across the city. The fleet of 9 all-electric, zero-emission delivery trucks is funded by a $9.5 million settlement between the New York Attorney General's office and American Electric Power over the company's violations of the Clean Air Act. Diesel delivery trucks contribute 70% of fine soot pollution in the city. Current levels are said to contribute to 2,300 premature deaths and 6,300 emergency room visits for respiratory and heart disease each year. Children in the South Bronx, Northern Manhattan, and Central Brooklyn, where the city's waste transfer stations are located and where low-income communities of color live, are three times as likely as other children to suffer from asthma.
And a Department of Investigation report says Mayor Bill de Blasio violated conflict of interest rules after being warned repeatedly not to solicit donations from individuals actively seeking tax breaks, deed transfers, and other favors from his administration. The report was obtained by Greg B. Smith, reporter for the news website The City. He says,
he formed this not-for-profit a long time ago called Campaign for One New York, and he raised $4.3 million from it by asking people who do business with his administration for money and donations, which they gave to him. And many of these people, at the time that he was personally asking them for money, were doing business with the city and specifically trying to get tax breaks, tax credits. One of them was looking for a deed transfer of city property. And he did this while they were actively seeking favors from his administration. What I wrote about today is that the city Department of Investigation did an investigation into this and determined that he violated ethics rules by doing this. And the report that they issued, which I obtained under the Freedom of Information Law, specifically stated that he had been warned about doing this and he did it anyway.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to get that from when you did the Freedom of Information Act request? Was it a FOIA or FOIL?
Okay, so it's FOIL because it's the state of New York. This is a municipal agency. So it's subject to release under the state law. And so to answer your question, this report was filed back in October but was not publicly released. No one knew about it. And so I learned about it, and I asked them in January, in the very early January, I would like to see this report. So after months of going back and forth, they finally released this thing to me last Friday. And when I got it, it's heavily censored. So if you look at it, and on our website, The City, you can see it. It's there's all these like paragraphs that have been covered up with black ink. And their justification for doing this is they're trying to protect witnesses. And they don't want to say anything about something that was unsubstantiated. However, they did substantiate the ethics violation that the mayor was soliciting donations from people who are doing business, actively doing business with his city hall.
What is an ethics violation? What does that mean in the real world?
It's a conflict of interest. There are all city employees. You've probably seen these reports. You see these reports where there's a thing called the Conflict of Interest Board. And they will issue these findings, public findings, by the way, in which they excoriate some city, bureaucrat for using their city vehicle to go home or to, work on Amway while they're at their job. And they sometimes fine people, and they sometimes just, admonish them with a public letter. And so the Conflict of Interest Board has all these rules about whether, you're basically, the idea is you don't want city employees doing things that that favor themselves, using the public, their public position to benefit themselves. And in this particular case, the idea of this is that they don't want the mayor of the city of New York asking people for donations to his not-for-profit while from people who are in a kind of a vulnerable position. They're seeking tax breaks from his administration. They're looking to get some city property from his administration. And here he is calling them up personally and saying, I would like you to donate to my cause. Put yourself in the position of that donor. What are you going to do? You're going to say to yourself, well, if I don't give money to this guy, what's that going to do for my chances of getting a tax break? So that's the idea of trying to get people to not do things that violate the conflict of interest regulations.
What does that have? What effect does that have on the mayor? What you've discovered in this report, could that lead to criminal charges, or could that just be an embarrassment?
This is a strictly an ethical situation. This is an ethics violation. And here's the background on this situation. He was also investigated for this kind of stuff by the U.S. attorney and Manhattan District Attorney, and both of them found that he had done some unethical stuff, but they didn't charge him with a crime because they didn't feel that whatever he was doing rise to the level of criminal activity. But there is, but the as the DOI report makes very clear, this is an ethical violation.
How to just to sum up? What does this mean about the mayor? What kind of mayor do we have?
The term that the New York Times used when they first wrote about this was the transactional mayor. So he is now thinking about running for president. He is specifically, you know, he's continuing to raise money, by the way, to be able to travel around the country and to explore a potential White House bid. He is a mayor who has, you know, during his tenure, been very comfortable reaching out to people, mostly real estate developers, by the way, who need things from City Hall, seeking donations from them. That's the transactional mayor that we're talking about.
Greg B. Smith is a reporter for the news website The City. The mayor's office, which has had the DOI report since Friday morning, did not respond to detailed questions submitted by The City Wednesday morning. Instead, a spokesperson released a brief statement. These questions are asked and answered. Fundraising for the now-defunct campaign for One New York was thoroughly reviewed by multiple parties, and it was determined there was no wrongdoing. It is said a million times the mayor acted lawfully and ethically.
Elsewhere around the boroughs, residents of Community Board 3 in Manhattan's Lower East Side were taken by surprise when representatives from the city's Department of Design and Construction revealed that flood protection plans that had already underwent 4 years of community review would be replaced by a new plan. Called the East Side Coastal Resiliency Project, the project aims to raise East River Park and install underwater seawalls. WBAI's Paul DiRienzo spoke with Naomi Schiller, local resident and anthropologist and member of the East River Alliance. She says the sudden about-face by the city has left the community reeling and full of unanswered questions.
We have a lot of questions about, you know, the lack of you know, respect for the community, the lack of respect for a democratic process. They, you know, they have a lot of reasons why they changed the plan. They're always sort of shifting their reasons. And, you know, one day it's because we can't close the FDR. Another day it's because, you know, this project was going to take too long. You know, meanwhile, the clock has been ticking. And what we've been asking for is we want independent experts, right, that can evaluate this plan. Does it really make sense? Is it really better than the old plan? The governor convened a panel of independent experts to look at the L train shutdown, for example. The neighborhood parks, Brooklyn Heights in Brooklyn, a very wealthy neighborhood, was able to convene, you know, experts to try to and through pressure from elected officials, was able to convene a plan to rethink the BQE redesign. So we are also asking for an independent panel of experts to look at, you know, does this plan really meet the demands of the most recent climate science about sea level rise and the long-term impacts on our air, on our water quality, the impacts of, you know, displacing all this water onto other communities around us. So we have a lot of demands, and we're really concerned that equity has been, you know, pushed to the side, and this plan is a fast-track plan to force this sort of down our throats without consideration of really important questions. And we're in a difficult spot because we want flood protection. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So they're sort of holding a gun to our heads about that any delay is the threat that another Hurricane Sandy is going to come along, and that somehow it will be on us for delaying the plan if that happens before flood protection is in place. It's been really challenging to figure out how to tackle this.
Why, after spending all that time and effort, why would they just radically rip it up? Who gains? You know, the old Latin saying, you know, who benefits?
We don't have a lot of information about, people have raised questions about who is gaining from this. What are the financial interests behind this? And we haven't come up with any information about that. I mean, I think what is clear is that there was a reorganization of the Department of Design and Construction, and the commissioner, Lane Grillo, was brought in, and her new deputy commissioner, who we've been dealing a lot, who's in charge of this sort of project manager on this, Jamie Springer, came in, and they came in with a mandate to bring projects to a close on a timeline, DDC, the Department of Design and Construction, is notorious for going way over budget and taking forever, right? And you can dig into the various projects that this has happened to, that they've been over, you know, they've been responsible for. So I think, you know, they were under this pressure to look at this project. This was one of the first projects they looked at, and they said, I mean, at least what they said to the community is, you know, it's not realistic for us to do this in the timeline that is set forth. And also the budget isn't realistic. So the budget, you need to understand, went from $760 million for the old project to $1.45 billion for this new project to build roughly 2 miles of a seawall along Lower Manhattan. It's also important to know that all of these seawall projects are happening in piecemeal fashion around Lower Manhattan. So this is just the East Side Coastal Resiliency Project. Yeah.
Just focusing on the Lower East Side, they want to spend more money. The new project, the new plan, is double what the old plan was.
Exactly. So we have a lot of questions. One of the most popular designs several years ago was a design to actually deck the FDR, to place decking on top of it, and to use part of that decking and berm system to create coastal flood protection, which would have, I mean, it's complicated, but it had the possibility of possibly reducing emissions in a community. There are 10,000 NYCHA residents who live along East River Park where this is happening, right? The majority of people who live right on this park, right, who are going to be, this is a frontline community who are facing, you know, massive problems with quality of air over the at least 3.5 years that this project is going to take. That's what they say it's going to take, but we know it's going to be probably a lot longer. So, you know, thinking about the lives and air quality of an environmental justice community, yeah, we have a lot of questions about all of this.
All right.
Naomi Schiller. That was Naomi Schiller, local resident and member of the East River Alliance. Construction is expected to begin in 2020.
And in more community news, in the Bronx, parents are calling for diaper-changing stations to be installed in the building housing the Bronx Supreme Court. Housing Court, Bar Association, Passport Office, and Census Office, that's according to reports from the city. Last year, both Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo signed laws requiring diaper-changing day stations to be present in public restrooms.
The Queens Public Library will be hosting an art exhibition featuring the work of artists with mental health issues at the Central Library in Jamaica. The exhibit will run from April 25th through May 5th at 8911 Merrick Boulevard.
Elsewhere in Queens, the Ridgewood Tenants Association rallied against landlord Silvershore Properties, whose former owner Jonathan Cohen was named the city's worst landlord in 2017 by then public advocate Letitia James. Tenants protest Silvershore's alleged harassment tactics designed to get them to leave so rents can be raised.
And in a new report released Friday, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers' presence outside New York courthouses has been revealed to be causing more immigrants to miss their court dates. According to the Brooklyn Eagle, in Brooklyn, there was the highest number of ICE courthouse arrests, 35 in 2018, and that both victims and witnesses are now fearing coming to court, according to the Brooklyn DA, Eric Gonzalez. ICE arrests outside courthouses have spiked 1,700% in New York State since 2016, according to a January report by the Immigration Defense Project.
And in breaking news, we have a breaking story. North Korea announced that it's test-fired a new type of tactical guided weapon. The Korean Central News Agency says Chairman Kim Jong-un observed the firing of the weapon Wednesday by the Academy of Defense Science. The agency reports that Kim said the development of the weapon system serves as an event of very weighty significance in increasing the combat power of the People's Army. The agency says Kim mounted an observation post to learn about the test fire of the new type tactical guided weapon and guide the test fire. The announcement came after reports of new activity at a North Korean missile research center and long-range rocket site where the North is believed to build long-range missiles targeting the U.S. mainland. The White House said it was aware of the report and had no comment. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, April 17th, 2019. The news was anchored with Heather Chin. It was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.